Lisa, how did your interest in foraging begin and why?
You know, a lot of people ask me that question. And, you know, I didn't really intend on being a quote unquote forager. Rather, foraging and wild plants has been, you know, really a part of my entire life. I grew up just a few miles from the Big Lake, and I had a family that, you know, we were outside all four seasons. And getting outside, my mom kept a garden. So I had a garden in my life. She canned and preserved what we got out of the garden and farmers markets. But we also had wild Concord grapes. I knew where the wild apples were. You know, my first pie in college, my college apartment was mulberry pie. And so I've just, as memories come back to me from my childhood, I've always had a really close relationship to the land around me.
So did your mother, when you were growing up, did she sometimes bring things in, not just from the garden, but from the area where you live?
You know, we were really big, you know, we were big on morels, the wild asparagus, especially out towards Shelby. For those that aren't familiar with the Shelby area, it's, you know, not just a big area for cultivated asparagus, but it's also all over the dune and sandy soil areas of Western Michigan. Not the nettles. I mean, we had a pretty traditional 80s childhood alongside of, you know, our garden harvest too. So macaroni and cheese, and, you know, there was McDonald's as a special treat. So I did have a normal childhood, as most Americans could relate. But definitely there was always that presence of both food from the garden and just an appreciation for the wild foods that grew around us.
Normal as in processed foods.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's like I have a long, you know, professional and academic background in food systems and local food systems. So I can appreciate both sides of what, you know, the food system could and should be in terms of a closer relationship to the land and nature and the different economic variables, but also recognize, you know, what the reality is, you know. So, mm-hmm. Yep, solid 80s childhood. Good and the good, the bad, and the ugly.
So tell us a little bit more about that background. You mentioned academia, and this isn't your first book either. So tell us a little bit more.
You know, I didn't think much about food. Actually, growing up, I always wanted to be a music education major in college, and I wanted to go and professionally be a music teacher, a band director. Music has always been a really big thing in my life. I actually ended up at Grand Valley studying music, but switched to anthropology at my dad's recommendation. And that's where I really started studying agriculture, the rise of agriculture in the Neolithic, actually was my interest and focus. And I just started studying food and really focused on all of the different components of food and how it pertains to humans. So the economics, the political, the social constructs we have around food. And every subsequent job, I lived out in Napa Valley. I studied in, you know, Nice in France, worked up north on a salad farm in Leelanau County, started a nonprofit to teach kids about vegetables with school gardens because of my experiences in California volunteering at the Edible Schoolyard. So I've really gathered my background around food systems and food just from a really, really diverse and delicious background and journey.
So how did you find that kids responded to this gardening and foraging?
You know, I think most profoundly, I had the chance to meet Alice Waters and work in the Edible Schoolyard in Berkeley back in 2000 and 2001 in California. And people think about Berkeley being a really high-end community, and really you have a whole gamut of socioeconomic backgrounds in the area. And we were working, you know, the Edible Schoolyard, for those that don't know, it is a little bit over an acre urban school garden with kitchen classrooms built into the school. And it was a really unique experience where kids of all backgrounds, you know, they were learning things they didn't know they were learning. They were learning science, math, world studies, nutrition, ecology, all from getting outside, growing food, making compost, taking the bounty into the kitchen and then, you know, preparing things like frittatas and then serving one another with the meals that we created. And, you know, it was a really profound experience, things very simple. But that, to me, you know, it's hands-on learning. It's learned by doing. It's getting kids outside, connecting to nature, especially in an urban environment. And then, you know, you start learning the wild weeds, of course, as gardeners, you know, the dastardly weeds. Most of them are edible and useful as both food and herbal medicine. So the learning can just, you know, just compound from those learning experiences. And that goes for adults, too, that the opportunities for us to get outside and learn from those places are really life-changing and diverse.
So in your world, Lisa, is there such a thing as a weed, or everything has a purpose?
You know, I think actually, I believe everything has a purpose in nature. I believe I get a lot of inspiration from the natural world. The natural world is really complex, and the systems are built with checks and balances and really fascinating just design. So, you know, weeds as a gardener, I'm fascinated by the concept of gardening because we like this sense that we can control life, we can control nature, and gardening gives us that sense of control. We can weed, we can keep things in order. Mm-hmm. So there is some very interesting contrast between the wild world and the cultivated. But that said, you know, I'm at a place now where I don't have a vegetable garden, you know, at my current home. So my wild gardens are along my running route. They're along, you know, the hedgerow that's in the back of my home. They're in these spaces where, you know, I've had to really come to terms with embracing not having these formal places where I can grow, but instead find solace and peace with all of the wild plants. And it's fun because the running routes, I know the names of all the plants, and those are the plants that would be deemed as invasive or weedy mm-hmm. by, you know, parks management staff. And to me, they're just as beautiful as the formal echinacea beds or the rhododendrons or things that you might find in one's more cultivated spaces.
So urban ranch no longer exists?
It's part of my family's garden. So it's part of my family. So my children, I'm a divorced mother. So they reside at the gardens I garden for my ex-husband. It's a running joke that, you know, I'm still the in-house gardener. But, you know, there's a sense of it really challenges on a very personal level sense of place, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, for me, foraging isn't just an act of putting food on my plate. It's challenging my concept of self, my identity, my connection to place, the concept of, you know, life and death. I recently lost my father. Mm-hmm. So challenging these ideas of, you know, just limits, and that the things all have a season and an end to things. And so having a relationship with different places and looking for, you know, opportunities to build my next gardens or farms, or even maybe do I need that type of thing with the beauty of our farmers markets. All there are lots of different layers that I can pull in.
Burdock and Rose, that's your business. Yes. Tell us more about that.
So, my work has really evolved. Burdock and Rose is my botanicals brand that came out of an experience on a local farm maybe 6 years ago, nearly, as I was foraging for burdock in the celery fields, the old celery fields of an organic farm here outside of Grand Rapids. And Burdock and Rose, my best girlfriend laughs and says that it sounds like Starsky and Hutch, this this rogue team of plants. And of course, my birth name, last name is Rose. And really, it's the overlying business that covers my botanical work, my herbal studies, my herbal practice, my writings, and just a catch-all for me to be able to share all that I love about wild edibles and wild medicinals.
Now, before we move on to talking about your new book, Midwest Foraging, I'd like to just a little bit touch on your previous book, Grand Rapids, A Culinary Revolution. Tell us, in maybe in a nutshell, what that book was about, and is there really a food revolution underway?
Grand Rapids Food is a book that I authored in 2012, released in 2013 by the History Press in Charleston. And I was asked to write a documentary about the food system and the evolution of the quote-unquote food scene in Grand Rapids. And because of my 15 years of, you know, being here in the Grand Rapids community, I was able to draw not just on my experiences, but help tell the stories of the farmers, the food activists, the political scene that really helps inform what goes on in our food community, the entrepreneurs, and then some of the social justice issues surrounding food right here in Grand Rapids. And to the question of, is there a food revolution? I think there is. There are different components of things happening politically, socially, and in general, there's an awareness from the consumer as to the needs for change within our industrialized food system. You know, the needs to really change how our animals are raised, how the impacts of factory farms, not just for the animals, but the environmental impact and the impact on human health, how we are eating food, raising food, preparing it at the table, the connection to our own personal health and wellness. And that's really, really, really continuing to snowball, and I think we'll continue to push change in the coming years.
Now, a lot of your work is with medicinal herbs. Is modern medicine lacking something that we need to kind of go back to what our grandmothers were doing? Or tell me about that.
I have a really strong interest in community health and personal wellness. And, you know, as a disclaimer, I really believe there's a role for conventional medicine. I've blown out my ACL. I've, you know, relied on MRIs for imaging to understand what's happened in my own body. Those are fabulous, fabulous instruments to help us understand the human body. That said, I've worked all over the world, you know, spent a month in Nicaragua working at a clinic where, because of political and historical reasons, and being one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere, they rely greatly on traditional herbs as part of their you know, the grandmothers in the kitchen as part of their regular mm-hmm. daily medicines. They don't have access to medical mile as we do here in, you know, Grand Rapids, Michigan. And a lot can be done with herbal remedies, and a lot can be done with things for everyday wellness that are right outside our back door. So as an extension of my work in food systems, you know, in the past 8 years, my interest in working with local plants, working with them in a medicinal way, it really gives me another perspective on what wellness can be and how useful it is to not just care about the role of heirloom tomatoes, but to know about the wild plants and how the herbs can be used for everyday wellness.
So Midwest Foraging, 115 wild and flavorful edibles from burdock to wild peach. Tell us how that came together, your journey of putting this book together.
The Midwest Foraging is really a compendium of all the plants that I know in my own little backyard world that can be found across the Midwest region. When I got the finished book in hand, it took me about 2 years to produce from signing with Timber Press to getting the finished copy. But when I got it in hand, I really looked at the book as a compendium of all of my experiences, you know, my experiences as I started our interview, my childhood being outside, you know, having access to this beautiful Michigan landscape, to really deepening my relationship with plants as I know how to use these foods for both food and medicine. And it's been a really exciting journey to see people take interest in how, because it's not just a field guide, but it's really infused with a little bit of my own philosophy of how I view foraging and how I interpret plants' usage and their usefulness in the kitchen.
So the plants that you chose here, those 115 edibles, are they medicinal or are they something you can add to your kitchen, your culinary palate, or both?
So the first book, actually, as I was writing the book, I included medicinal properties, and Timber Press had recommended and secured me to write a second volume to this book, which will be Midwest Medicinal Plants. Mm. So we've separated out the wild edibles for culinary uses to be the focus in Midwest Foraging. And my subsequent book will be Midwest Medicinal Plants, which focuses on some are the similar plants, but medicinal uses, and then other plants that I use specifically with an herbal and medicinal focus.
So when you forage these plants and berries that you find, is there something that is missing from our diet, or is it just that we've narrowed things that we eat and you're expanding on that? What's the idea behind this?
I think there's a combination both of the lack of variety in our diet as well as an appreciation for flavor that particularly Americans are missing.
Yeah.
The standard American diet includes two flavors, essentially salty and sweet. The wild flavors of plants have different nuances. They have the bitter, they have salty, but it's not salty like salt and vinegar potato chips salty, but it might be a salty flavor in the nettle that actually might be indicative more of its mineral density. Or the sweetness might not be the sweetness of a glazed donut. And I will say I love kettle chips and glazed donuts, okay?
I hear you.
I don't want your listeners to think I'm this purist, because I'm really not. I'm a realist.
Yeah,
donuts
yeah.
can be amazing. But the sweetness that's found in the earth is a sweetness of we have the fruits, of course, but then we also have, you know, the sweetness of slippery elm or the sweetness of the carbohydrates that come by way of nature. So the palate, and I found this a lot when working with kids in gardens and tasting new foods, there's a lot of palate education that needs to happen and finding language to talk about new flavors and textures differently than just, oh, Miss Rose, this is nasty. So I try to get people to think, okay, beyond your immediate response of this is nasty, what are you tasting? Is it spicy? Does it make your mouth tingle? Is it a coarse texture that you're at first kind of surprised by? So it's getting people comfortable tasting new foods to then be open to wild flavors, thus increasing diversity in their diet and on their plates.
Now, where would you usually, you mentioned when you go out as a runner that you find things along your trail or your path, wherever you're running. Where would people usually start looking for something? I imagine on their own yards. But what about the risks? How long does an area have to be unsprayed? How do you know that it hasn't got some kind of pollutants in it? How do you stay safe?
So safety is always a concern when you're foraging or gathering plants for your own dinner table. And for me, I get people to think about the history of the use of the land. Your question was how do I know? And part of it is, as you go about learning from what's outside your doorstep, absolutely is the most sensible thing for a couple of reasons. One, you know, if you're planning on going out into the backcountry, you need to do your due diligence first and actually learn the plants outside your own doorstep before you go to another place and harvest plants. But it also gives you a good starting point to be able to do the research, to start to map out your immediate neighborhood. What is in your neighborhood? How has your neighborhood been used? Along the Grand River, most of the frontage is brownfield development. As a community gardener, you most likely would soil test before you plant a garden. As a forager, you might not be soil testing for things like lead and contaminants. So having a sense of history of use is always an important thing to do to inform you where it may or may not be safe or judicious to be harvesting. The second component to that is knowing what types of plants generally take up heavy metals or minerals. So your plants like, I'll use spinach, it's not, you know, a wild cultivar, but spinach takes up iron. As a gardener planting spinach in an area that's heavy in lead, the lead can be taken up into that plant. This, and then subsequently you'd eat that plant.
Yeah.
The same can happen with really mineral dense wild edibles like dock, nettle, plants that you're eating because they have a high mineral content, which we absolutely need. We need more plants in our diet with high minerals because of the way we're raising food industrially in industrial agriculture. But we can't be getting those plants in areas where we believe there may be heavy metal contamination because that will be an issue in the plant parts. So knowing your plants, knowing how contaminants take place in the plants, that's an important other half to know. So I really encourage people to be thinking about those things as they embark on their foraging journey.
And it's probably harder and harder to find clean land. I've heard as much as 100 years to, say, have something certified as organic, for instance. Is there a time period that, you know, if you've lived in one place a long time and you know that lawn hasn't been treated?
You know, I mean, conventional agriculture transitioning to organics, you know, the process, the certification process takes about 3 years. Whether or not that means that the land is completely free of contaminants, you know, that may take, you know, longer than that. Of course, heavy metals are never, they never go away. Those will always remain in the ground unless you're intentionally remediating the soil over time. So, you know, and then philosophically, that kind of leads us down the path of talking about, will the land ever, I mean, I live in the city, so is it possible to really ever find completely pure land?
Right.
They're saying that sprayed lawns actually still have a less residual herbicide and pesticide applications than conventional food found in the grocery store.
Mm.
So, I mean, these things are all not, they're all shades of gray. I think they're parts to help influence us in making choices. I usually don't expect everybody to go and add wild, like have 3 wild food meals a day. But if we can gather some, I can help change people and their perceptions on the weeds in their lawn, so they might not spray the next season. They add some red clover or some violet leaves to their salad and slowly change perceptions over time. I think that's a step in the right direction.
So if you were lost on an island, you would never starve, would you, Lisa?
That's one of the things that no one will ever be able to take from me. I will always be able to make it out, God willing, alive and definitely not hungry.
So what's the best way to start for a complete novice? What's your advice?
You know, I do recommend getting outside. You can't be a forager or gather wild plants without really getting outside and becoming comfortable with nature. And that sounds like a pretty simple thing, but a lot of us have lost that regular sense of getting outside on a regular basis. So just like a gardener would know the seasons of plants, getting outside on a regular basis, watching the stages of growth of plants is important. Finding out, you know, that the dandelion leaves taste better when it's cooler in the early morning, under the early morning light and in the early dew, than in the middle of the day, in the middle of the summer, when the leaves become bitter, coarse, and hairy, and quite frankly, to small children, unpalatable.
Mm.
And we want to get our kids to like those greens, right?
Right.
So, you know, you start to really experiment. Of course, positively IDing plants is an absolute must. Going to the library, start reading botanical ID guides. There's never just one that can fit the bill. So I'm like a closet, actually not so closet, ID collector, botanical guide collector. So over time, you might find your world taking over with books and books, and then, you know, you'll start drying plants from your rafters and your family will wonder what happened to you. So it'll all snowball by getting outside.
So carrying your book along, it's a gorgeous book, but it's not something you put in your pocket either. But you have these wonderful glossy photos of plants, which do make it easier to identify something. What's the most common thing, though? Again, with that novice going out for a walk in the woods, what's the most common things you could say, those three, four, five plants that you might look for? You've mentioned dandelions.
Yeah. So, you know, this summer right now, it's high July, and the black raspberries, the red raspberries, we're coming into, you know, wild apples and crab apples. These are really easy foods to get excited about and pay attention to. The wild, the staghorn sumac makes a delicious lemonade type beverage that doesn't require lemonade. And with my book in tow, you know, I really felt it was important to make foraging and wild plants accessible to people, like to the mom that wants to take her kids out to the park and start pointing out wild plants, or to the foodie going on a picnic that might want to venture into being more creative in the kitchen with wild edibles. So it's not, I mean, while it's solid and it's botanical language and can help you properly ID things, it's not so highbrow and inaccessible as a botanical guide. And it gets people thinking about flavors and types of ways to incorporate even different herbs, and like the wild Monarda into an herbed pizza. So there's a lot of different ways you can start incorporating these plants as a beginner.
I was pretty excited when I looked at your book and I went for a walk out in my back field. I realized there's a grocery store back there and it's all free.
Yeah, I really think people don't realize once you start learning the plants, how we are surrounded by such a bounty given to us by the earth. And then too, I think once you start having that relationship, the relationship grows this stewardship mindset for people. So we don't see them as weeds anymore. We see them as wild gardens. I have an appreciation then for the plantain that's growing wild in my neighbor's yard. I don't look at it and say, oh my goodness, I wish that guy would mow. I know what role these plants have in our ecosystem and in our landscape. And then by way of that, I just feel as I'm one of their compatriots rather than, you know, somebody out to spray them with a topical broadleaf weed killer.
I've come to appreciate jewel weed now that I live in a place where poison ivy is around.
Yes, jewel weed is something that every outdoors person should know and should learn, because invariably, especially if we're careless and overstep our boundaries, we'll come into contact, unfortunately, with poison ivy, and it's love bites is what I tell my kids, there's love kisses from the poison ivy, just reminding us to pay attention and to stay in our place as we should.
And they tend to grow side by side, I've noticed. Isn't that wonderful how nature works that out?
Yes, nature puts things into a pattern, and there are rhymes and reasons to those patterns, and it's always good to learn where the remedies are right next to the ailment. So,
well, I'm looking forward to that medicinal book that you'll be putting together soon.
I am too. In fact, I'm nearly midway for the copy, and I've handed a good chunk off of it recently for editing. So I'm well on track for getting that next book out within the next year and a half. And really do appreciate the increased excitement around wild edibles that's growing here in West Michigan.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for hosting, Zinta, and I appreciate your continued work in local food systems and support of my own writings as well.